I'd like to welcome this evening Kate Lyle-Grant. Kate is an editor who's worked in mainstream trade publishing for over 20 years, and for the past 15 as a senior commissioning editor for Hodder & Stoughton, and most recently Simon & Schuster, specialising in crime, thrillers and commercial women's fiction. Best-selling authors she has acquired and edited include Chris Manby, Matt Dunn, Terence Strong, Karen Quinn for the Ivy Chronicles, Chris Carter, the Crucifix Killer, and Nicola Krauss and Emma McLaughlin, The Nanny Diaries. She now divides her time between freelancing as an editorial consultant for Seven House publishers and working with unpublished authors to lick their scripts into shape before approaching literary agents. Welcome, Kate. Thank you for joining us this evening.
You're welcome.
And you've clearly had a long and distinguished career as an editor, and you know that certainly puts you in an ideal position to advise new authors. I think new authors have a real sense, sometimes, not always, that there is a sense of kind of doom and gloom about the industry at the moment, and that it's very difficult to break through. Perhaps that's something that new authors always feel, whatever the state of the market. I wonder, first of all, how you view the current marketplace for new work, really.
Sure. I mean, publishers are always full of doom and gloom. But there's no doubt it is tough at the moment. There are very few outlets now for mainstream publishers to get books out in volume. Borders went into administration at the end of last year, unfortunately. So you've got Waterstones, Smiths and the supermarkets. That's basically it, as the big players. So buying decisions are in the hands of very few key buyers. You can count on the fingers of one hand, basically. So it tends to be pretty risk averse at the moment, and consequently publishers are being pretty cautious about taking risk on first-time novelists, particularly those who don't fit into a recognisable genre necessarily. Having said that, there are deals going on all the time for debut novelists, and a lot of six-figure deals being reported. So it is still happening. And if you've got the right book that publishers are looking for, they'll all be biting your hand off for it, particularly in the run-ups to the two big book fairs, with the Frankfurt Book Fair in October and the London Book Fair in April. Yeah. Everyone wants to have a good, exciting debut on their list for those fairs. So there are still deals going on, and first-time novelists can break through.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting. I was, this weekend I was at the Shakespeare & Co. Literary Festival in Paris, and I suppose just to play the devil's advocate, one of the speakers there was saying that actually if one is always trying to write to genre, and I fully understand the need to do that, but effectively he was saying, for example, if you have lots of people trying to write the next Harry Potter, but actually J.K. Rowling wasn't trying to write the next Harry Potter. She was actually... you know, nobody was saying, we want the first Harry Potter book.
Exactly.
She was kind of doing something original and carving out her own way. So I just wondered about that whole, you know, I suppose she was fitting into children's fiction. Is that what you mean by genre? Is it as wide as that? Or are we talking about actually this whole area of trying to do something the way others are doing it?
Yes. I mean, children's fiction is a very different kettle of fish, which I don't have much experience with. It's on a whole different editors. And J.K. Rowling famously was turned down by 19 publishers and several agents, so she didn't find it easy to get her first deal. Mm-hmm. But it does just take one editor to see it and to fall in love with your book. And the first Harry Potter book was famously bought for £3,000, mm-hmm, by Bloomsbury, who just decided to take a risk on what was at the time seen as, you know, a pretty old-fashioned, middle-class children's story. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, well, you know, we won't pay very much money for it.
Yeah.
See where it goes, and the rest is history. But
are there small deals still going on and happening now, or is that a thing of the past? It's either a big deal or it's no deal?
There is a case for it's either a big deal or it's no deal. I mean, Transworld, famously, they've got to reckon the book can sell at least 50,000 copies, otherwise they won't make an offer for it. But I think this is the time for small publishers who can take those small deals and take those risks. There are a lot of small publishers who are cropping up on the Booker Prize shortlists, for example, or getting some surprise bestsellers under their belts, who wouldn't have had a look in a few years ago, but they're able to take the risks that the big publishers just aren't at the moment. So it's an exciting time from that perspective.
Yes, yeah. What about the publisher you're currently working for, Seven House? What is it that, how does Seven House fit into the marketplace?
Sure. Seven House is it's a fairly specialist niche publisher. There are 10 people in the office. And it specialises in picking up the kind of mid-list authors who've been turned down by the bigger publishing houses because their mass market paperback sales are no longer holding up, perhaps. But they do still have a loyal and dedicated readership. Mm-hmm. And because we're a smaller publishing company with less overheads, we can afford to take on books which just have those lower sales figures. And we publish in hardback and trade paperback only, and the primary customer is libraries, but we also do independent specialist bookshops. We sell to an Amazon or a good customer. Mm. So Seven House is one of the few publishers that are expanding at the moment, because at the moment when these really strong mid-list authors are being dropped by the big publishing houses, we can pick them up, and there's some fantastic authors on the list.
And presumably you can, it's a bit like the bionic man, I'm thinking, you can rebuild them.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And then we can, then they kind of get poached back by the bigger publishers again.
Mm.
Like one of the authors on our list, we've just sold the paperback rights to Orion Publishers. So, and I'm sure, you know, if it works for them, they'll poach him again. Mm. And HarperCollins Avon have just taken on another of our authors. So exactly, it's one of those things.
There's so much talk as well about the independent bookshops being kind of swallowed up by, as you say, you know, there's only a few outlets for books these days. Do you see that is that going to continue the way you see it? Do you have a sense that, I suppose, can the independent bookshops survive in the current climate?
I would hope so. They've got to find their market, and I would tell people to use your local independent bookshop and buy from them if you want them to survive. And I personally think it's very important to maintain that diversity and choice of books that you've got, because, I mean, I personally find it really boring going into bookshops these days because it's all the same six books in the 3 for 2s or buy one, get half price promotions. There's no kind of choice anymore. And what I love doing is browsing and you know, finding some unexpected treasures. So I think, if an independent bookshop can find its market and work, you know, the ones that are surviving, quite a few will have gone by the wayside.
Mm.
I think they will. You know, find their readership and have a space in the market.
Yeah. I mean, it was certainly something that struck me. I feel obviously sort of Shakespeare and Co. being a kind of sort of ideal, almost sort of perfect independent bookshop, but just sort of going in there and seeing the difference about the sort of diversity of books that were there. It certainly made, and the kind of the passion of the people for books there, it certainly made me feel that actually, you know, There's a lot of room for change in it. You know, obviously there's the big conglomerates, but I also think there's a lot of people out there who want that kind of diversity and choice. And it just struck me that that's something that writers should be aware of. But obviously writers also need to be aware of, you know, the real world of commercial publishing as well.
Absolutely. And I think the internet is, you know, a growing market. In that respect, more and more books are being sold online, and Amazon, and there are some, you know, good rival bookselling internet sites coming up, can give you that diversity. What they won't buy, they won't buy books in bulk, you know, they'll just buy 2 or 3 copies. So,
who won't buy books in bulk? Is that?
Those are Amazon. And any of those internet booksellers, they won't sort of buy up hundreds of copies. They'll just have enough in their warehouse, but they'll keep reordering and reordering, and then suddenly as publishers you'll look over the course of a year and say, my goodness, we've sold thousands through Amazon, but it kind of creeps up on you slowly.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So if we think about, you know, what new authors can do to, you know, get their work through really at the end of the day, or to make the best books they can make, what do you think new authors need to do to attract the attention of a literary agent and obviously later a publisher?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I would say do your research on the literary agents and find out what they're looking for and what they take on their list. Like, there's no point sending your science fiction novel to a literary agent who doesn't do science fiction, etc., which sort of is stating the obvious, really. Have a good covering letter telling them a bit about yourself, the sort of salient points about yourself, any interesting features, how or why you came to write this book. No need to go on at length, but a couple of pages would be great. A synopsis, just a few paragraphs. So don't tell the whole story. Make it sound as much like a book blurb as possible, sort of something intriguing and tantalising. Mm-hmm. And then the first three chapters in the first instance, make sure it's double-spaced, well-typed, well-spelt. I mean, that's the best advice I can give, really.
Yeah. I mean, although you're an editor, so you kind of see things that come through agents, but you obviously know literary agents. Have you ever had conversations with them about how they deal with the huge amount of material they receive and how they filter that?
Yes, I mean, I often ask them how they get their authors, and very few seem to come through the slush pile, although some do. Obviously, there's a lot of personal recommendations, word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
That's anything that will enable someone to stand out from the crowd. So make contacts and use them ruthlessly. I would advise.
Yeah, go to parties.
Yeah,
if you can. And
exactly, they do read their slush piles, but it just seems that very few authors come out that way. I don't know why that should be.
Sometimes it's a recommendation, isn't it? It's actually
they might send
in cold, but they've been recommended by somebody that the agent knows, for example, or something like that. I imagine sometimes it's a very small detail that might make the agent pick it up and say, "Ah, this one is really of interest to me."
Exactly.
So what about the manuscripts themselves? You know, because obviously you are also making choices. You know, to an extent, material has been filtered because I presume the majority comes through literary agents or through direct recommendation to you.
Yes, I mean, everything from all the big publishers and most of the smaller ones comes through literary agents these days. We just don't have the manpower or time to go through the slush pile and take things direct from the public. So it has had that filter before, and the agent's covering letter or initial phone call is just so important to alert you to something and give you the relevant points. And agents know what you're looking for, and, you know, that's doing their job, basically.
If they're always doing a sales job on you, or different agents have different approaches? Do you have some agents that you trust more than others, for example?
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, the vast majority of agents are extremely good, and you do trust their judgment, absolutely. There are some agents who curry having a bit of a reputation as being a hot agent, and something that comes from them, yes, I guess you do tend to put it at the top of the pile. But any agent sort of doing their job properly. And it's all on their reputation as well, so there's no point them sending you something that's not really quite up to par.
Yeah.
And I've been finding agents these days do a lot more editorial work on novels before sending it to publishers, because it's so important to get it as polished as it can be, because publishers have so many layers of staff have been stripped away in recent years. Everyone's understaffed. Sales and marketing teams do have quite a lot of say in what goes through. So, and as an editor can kind of see how a novel could need some work, but how it could be. The sort of sales and marketing teams don't often have that kind of imagination, so it's worth the agent getting it as polished as possible before the big publishers make their decisions based on what is almost a finished work. So I'm finding I'm getting quite a few agents passing unpublished novelists on to me, which are kind of really good, but they just need a polish and an edit before going out to the marketplace.
Mm. And I've certainly sort of seen that in recently in relation to my own agent actually saying, you know, yes, I want to put this out for you, but no, it's not ready, and, you know, we need to work on it some more. So that's something that I think happened less often earlier in my career, although it was still happening even then. I've certainly been asked to cut 40,000 words from one novel by a literary agent before it went out. That was my tendency to overwrite. but what about when you are taking that decision? Are there, for example, quite common problems that you sometimes see in unpublished manuscripts? Is there something that an author might do that's likely to dissuade you from taking a project on, for example?
I mean, I do always find it annoying if an author says, oh, this is the most fantastic thing you're ever going to read, without telling me much about the novel itself. I think, you know, I'm going to be the judge of that. Thank you. Mm. And a thing, double space the manuscript rather than single space, because otherwise it is so difficult to read. But otherwise, I think most manuscripts come to us in pretty good shape.
What about content-wise? Do you see common errors that put you off, or is it not as simple as that?
No, I mean, I think it's most important to have the most striking and intriguing opening you can possibly have, can possibly get. I mean, some unpublished writers come to me and say, well, it gets so much better later on. I think, well, there's just no point. It's got to be really good right from the outset, because that is all people are going to read. That is all my colleagues are going to read. That's all the booksellers we're trying to sell you are going to read before they give up, because they've got so much other material to read. Mm. So the opening chapter is just absolutely vital to get the reader hooked.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's really. I think that's really useful for people to. I think people know that, but it's good to reinforce that. And what makes the difference between, is there something that you like and something that you love? Can you put your finger on what that might be?
I think something that I love would be something I just forget I'm reading it for work. I forget I'm reading a manuscript. I think I'm reading a book. I just forget everything else. I just want to find out what happens. And obviously I read an awful lot in my area. So something that's just a bit new and original and different, and that's what would be something that I love. I mean, something that I like could be something that I can appreciate that's very good of its genre, and I can see how we can sell it very easily.
Yeah.
But I've got more of my professional hat on.
So it's effectively to sort of sweep you away with the story, really, so that you just feel totally absorbed in that world.
Exactly.
And wanting to turn the page.
Exactly.
One of the areas that you specialise in is commercial women's fiction. How do you actually define that?
So it's a fairly broad umbrella, but basically they would all have a love story at their centre. Commercial women's fiction can be regional sagas, historical fiction, chick lit, or anything that would appeal more to a female readership, basically. It's just a broad term to describe any of that fiction, which mostly is written by women, although not entirely exclusively.
Mm. And we often hear this distinction between commercial fiction and literary fiction. How would you describe that distinction? Do you see a distinction there?
Sure. Yes, it's. I mean, it's sometimes quite frustrating for publishers, because we have to make that distinction because booksellers demand it. Literary fiction is, well, it's not genre fiction, so it's not crime, thrillers, horror, science fiction. They usually are published on a specialist literary imprint or publisher. That's the fiction that you would submit for the Booker Prize, the Costa Award, that kind of thing. But, you know, a thriller can be literary as well. When Child 44 was longlisted for the Booker Prize a couple of years ago, which is the thriller set in Moscow. Mm. There was a big hoo-ha, how can a thriller be on the Booker Prize longlist? I thought, well, why shouldn't a thriller be on the Booker Prize longlist? It's well written, it's gripping. And the head of Canongate Publishers, which literary publishing house, sort of sounded off about how terrible it was that this thriller was on the Booker longlist, and his own wonderfully erudite literary novelists weren't.
Mm.
I'm always very happy to work in so-called commercial fiction rather than literary fiction. I find the authors are much easier to deal with.
I think you're right. Yes, this sort of sense that, you know, if it's literary, therefore it's not genre. You know, it's kind of... I understand that distinction, but as you say, fiction that is seen as genre fiction can also be beautifully written and absolutely well-crafted and...
Exactly.
Readable. Yeah,
I mean, John le Carré writes thrillers, but they could also be seen as literary fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret Atwood, The Handmaid's Tale, I think that won the Fantasy Award for that year, but it was also literary fiction.
Yes.
So you don't have to have that distinction, but, you know, booksellers will always put that label on it.
Yeah. And I know it's not your area, but some of the people listening to this interview might be non-fiction authors, so I just want to ask brief question about that.
Mm.
Wondering if, in your view, there's a difference in the strategies that non-fiction authors should take. For example, self-help authors or business gurus, should they still aim to get a literary agent first? Are literary agents taking on that kind of author?
Absolutely, always. I would say get a literary agent first. I think if you just send to publishers direct, it will get put on this slush pile, it will get looked at by a work experienced person of that and not taken terribly seriously. Unfortunately, it's just lack of manpower on publishers' point, and the fact that it's such small returns from the slush pile direct from the public. I mean, you'd be lucky if you found one acceptable manuscript in 5 years is the kind of going rate. So it's just not worth it. So yes, get a literary agent. They do specialise in these areas. They know all the editors who would like that material. Non-fiction is sold differently than fiction in that you can sell it. It's sold on a basis of a proposal and perhaps a sample chapter, whereas a debut novel, some get sold on a partial manuscript, but sort of 90% of the time you've got to have written the whole novel before it gets submitted. So it's a lot of work on the part of the literary agents initially, several months' work most of the time before they see any financial return on their investment.
Yeah. So recently you've made a shift in the way in which you work. You're working for Seven House, but you're also working as a literary consultant, and I wondered how that affected your approach to the unpublished author. Do you feel differently about unpublished authors because you're now working with them directly?
Yeah. No, I don't feel differently about them at all. What I do have, which I didn't have before, is the time to go through their manuscripts in much more depth than I used to be able to do, and give them far more detailed feedback and constructive editorial advice about where they might be going wrong and how they might put it right. When I was a commissioning editor working for the big publishing houses, you just don't have the time, unfortunately, that you would like to. Your time's held up. I had sort of 30 to 40 ongoing authors on my list who had to take priority. I was always in meetings. So the sort of submissions pile took a back seat in that respect. When the hot books came in, which you knew every other publisher would be going for, you had to drop everything else and read those overnight. But the other things on your submissions pile, you sort of, you know, you'd snatched half an hour here and there to read when you had time, or often last thing at night when you're feeling a bit tired. And it was quite frustrating in that respect. And now I have the time to do it. And go through it with a fine-tooth comb. My advice is always the same as it would have been, and my relationship is the same with unpublished authors than it has been, than it was when I was a commissioning editor, in that I would like them to succeed. I would always want to give them constructive advice and the best advice I can give possible as to how they might get published and to channel their work with that in mind.
Mm. I'm just thinking, I wonder if some people might be discouraged by this idea that if you don't know somebody, if you can't drop a name, therefore you're going to be on the slush pile, therefore how are you going to attract this literary agent's attention? Do you think that's a fair fear to have?
Yes, I get asked that a lot. If you don't have any connections, my advice is if you have a good manuscript, you've got talent, it will be spotted by somebody. I have great belief in that. There are a lot of literary agents out there. There are a lot of editors out there. It just takes one person to pick it up and love it. So I would say, yes, go through the Writers and Artists Yearbook or the internet or whatever. Send it out to the literary agents and just persevere. I mean, there are a lot out there. There are at least 80, I would think, sending novels out in London. Mm. Or elsewhere in the UK, start with about 3 or 4 and carry on through the list. And if you've got the talent, it is good. Someone somewhere will recognise that and take you on. If it's not through personal recommendation, it might take a bit longer for them to pick it up and look at it. But they will get there.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm absolutely with you on that. It can be a bit of a slog, but it's only, as you say, it only takes one person. I asked some of my clients if they had questions that they wanted to ask you. So I'm just going to share a couple of those with you. One of my clients wanted to ask you, have you ever been tempted to write yourself, or do you write yourself?
No and no. I don't know. I'm not a writer. I'm a nurturer of writers, I think. I've never had any ambition to write. I don't have that faith in my own talent, and I don't have that self-discipline, I don't think, that would, to sit down day after day and finish that novel without any guaranteed return. I take my hat off to people to do that. You do that. I really do.
I think that's what we want to hear from an editor as well, to be honest, because I think that actually if all of our editors were really frustrated writers, then what would that say about the state of publishing at the end of the day? So I'm glad to hear that answer, really. It shows that you're in the right job. and another question that one of my clients wanted to ask you is whether you've ever told an unpublished author to take up another career.
To be honest, I felt like telling an unpublished author to take up another career, but I would never be so rude as to actually do so. I said I do try and give constructive advice because I know how important feedback is to unpublished authors, and I know the amount of work that has gone into it before it's got onto my desk. So, and I've met unpublished writers who've sort of quoted to me word for word a letter I sent them almost 15 years ago. So I know they do take it very much to heart, and I'm very conscious of that.
Yes.
And I'm very careful to be as tactful as possible if I don't think they have any talent.
Yeah. I want to return now just to something you said earlier. You talked about, I think it was Trans World, mm-hmm. needing to sell, was it 50,000 copies?
Yeah.
And I wondered whether, and this might vary from publisher to publisher, whether in the current climate or indeed ever, publishers might take a book on as more of a risk. I suppose it could almost be seen as a loss leader if they've got 5 books that they can sell their 50,000, but there's another that might not sell but they love. Could that book make it through?
Yes, absolutely. You have to believe that a novel has the potential to sell well. Obviously, some books will lose money. You can't help that. But the other book, there'll be the unexpected bestseller on the list that you've bought for £3,000, say. Yeah. That's what every publisher dreams of having, which will carry all the rest for the budget for that year. It's not an exact science. You can't say exactly how many copies a book will sell. All you can do is make an educated guess. And there are a lot of factors that are out of your control, like in recent years, the Richard and Judy Club has had an enormous impact on book sales, and you can buy a book saying, oh, I hope it gets picked for Richard and Judy, but you can't say that for sure.
Mm.
If it does, it's fantastic, but competition for those slots is intense. So, and you can buy it saying, oh, I think it's got a chance for the Romantic Novel of the Year award or the Crime Thriller Year of the Award. But you can't say that for sure. So it's always a risk. And that's the fun of it, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, it said in the first place, it's just finding that gem that you've got a passion for that you want to keep turning the pages of, presumably.
Exactly. And being able to share that passion with your colleagues and you know, infuse them with passion. It's got to start in-house. If there's a buzz about a book, if everyone in the publishing house loves it, that will transfer through to the booksellers, and that will hopefully transfer to the customers in the end.
Yeah.
So personal enthusiasm, which starts with the editor, is key.
I'm also thinking about the fact that, you know, we hear about how authors can get their work out there, and we hear an awful lot about the e-book revolution. Mm. We also hear sometimes things like publishers are running scared of e-books. Do you think that's true? And do you think it's a good thing for authors?
I think anything which encourages readers to read and finds new readers can only be a good thing. I think protecting copyright is going to be a challenge in the future. And nobody knows quite how the e-books will affect the market at the moment. People just make guesses. But I think for publishers, you know, the thing is to embrace the new technology rather than sort of run away from it. I think everyone is looking at the music industry and a bit worried about what happened there. They sort of handled it badly with this sort of new digital technology, and to make sure it doesn't happen with us. And I think it's a good thing in that there's not just one device which is dominating the market now. There seems to be a sort of healthy competition with Apple and Kindle and Sony e-readers. But as I said, nobody really knows for sure how it's going to impact on the book trade.
Yeah. And finally, if you could offer one piece of advice to new authors, you've given us so much in the course of this interview, but if you wanted to kind of really sum that up, what would be your message for new authors overall?
Sure. I mean, my advice would be to write from the heart, find your own voice, don't just jump on a bandwagon for the sake of it, and persevere. You know, that, as I said before, there are a lot of agents out there. If it's good, somebody will love it. So don't give up. Just keep on trying.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much, Kate. And I know that we have certainly one other person on the line this evening, which is Fiona. And Fiona, I wondered if, listening in, you had any additional questions that you wanted to ask Kate.
Yes, I do. There's a couple. I'd like to go back to when you were talking about new authors sending in stuff to agents. You mentioned that the synopsis should be more like the blurb that you get on the back of the book. It should sort of arouse the interest and not tell the ending. And I've just started doing that process of doing the synopsis and also writing a short, what I call back page blurb, because to me there's so much confusion on all these writing websites about what a synopsis is meant to be. So which do you prefer to see? Because I've actually read people saying it should be sort of no more than 2 pages long, but it's got to explain the whole arc of the story. Others say it should be a 10-page document, and others say send us just a paragraph. And the term synopsis seems to be used across all these variations.
I know, yes, synopsis. It's different synopsis work for different purposes, really. But for sending to agents, I would probably go with the less is more angle and have a few paragraphs and not tell the whole story, but just give a sort of intriguing insight. Make them want to read it. That's the key.
Mm-hmm. And then the synopsis, the longer synopsis, is that what the publishers want?
Not necessarily. Only if they sort of can't be bothered to read the book for themselves, which I hope would not be the case. I think the only way The only times I needed longer synopses was when we submitted for the Richard and Judy Prize, and they wanted long synopses which told the whole story, because obviously they weren't going to read all the books. So I would go with a few paragraphs. That's as a commissioning editor, that's what I would like to see, and that's the advice that I would give. And that's what agents will send to publishers generally.
Okay. Now that helps, because it is actually quite confusing. The other question I wanted to ask is do you need to know that an author's got more than one book in them if they're a debut novelist and you're thinking about, in a sense, investing in them?
Yes, that's a very good question. Absolutely, yes. You don't just want to do a one-book deal, because you have to break a new author into the market. You have, as a publisher, you really have to invest in them. You have to spend some time on marketing. You have to really get the word out. So it's very rare just to do a one-book deal for fiction. It's always two-book deals. And taking on new authors, always the first question I would ask them would be, what is your second novel about? Have you got a plan for it yet? And we always talk of the dreaded second novel test, because so many first-time novelists, they're not under pressure of a deadline. They've had all the time in the world to finish this first novel. A lot of them are very, there's a lot of autobiographical elements in that first novel. And then they've suddenly got to come up with something else. And as an editor, you want to find a fiction writer who's got a real long-term future, not just a one-book wonder.
And does it make any difference to you if there's a shift in genre, does it need to be a clone of the first successful?
I wouldn't say a clone, but it would be very helpful if it was in the same genre, yes. It's very hard when an author, and I can absolutely understand why, writes in a completely different genre every time, because you've got to build up a readership and carry those readers with you, and you can't if it's in a completely different genre. But on the other hand, you don't want an exact replica of the book before. You want something which has moved on a bit or got an original twist, but hopefully recognisably in the same genre, which will appeal to the same readership, is the key.
Uh-huh. Yeah, thanks.
Not at all.
Thanks. Well, thank you so much, Kate. That's been really interesting and really useful, just to get a real sense of an overview of, from your perspective as well, because I think from a new author's perspective, it's so rare to actually get the chance to hear the other side, effectively. And so it's great to have that sense of a summary of what it is that you're looking for, and, you know, what makes you love a book. So thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to speak to you again sometime soon.
Yes, of course. Not at all. My pleasure.
Yes, and thank you too, Kate. They're really, really useful. Thank you.
Oh, not at all.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. That's the official part done. We can cut the tape there, but... But thank you, Kate. That was, you know, really great. And I know that we'll get some fantastic feedback from the group. There's about, I think, about 26 members now.
Oh, great.
It's 29,
it's
Jackie.
Not, is it? Have I lost
yes.
count?
You've lost count.
Is that from the...
That's from the group thing.
I think that's slightly inaccurate, because sometimes some of the people are on twice, and I think it might still have Kate Bacon on there, who's not...
Oh, yes, she's still on it, yeah.
But it's so it's obviously somewhere between 26 and
29.
Maybe one up to 27, we'll check. Yes. But yes, it will have a sort of broad... the group, and there's a lot of, you know, very talented writers there, and then obviously, as I said, it will kind of go out as a on the website, on the new website as well. So thanks ever so much, Kate, that's brilliant. And so, yeah, and I was saying Kate's also going to go on the Writing Coach website as a consultant as well.
That's good.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Cheers. Well, au revoir.
Yeah. Have a good evening, everybody. It must be later. It's later still for you, isn't it?
It is still. Yes, it's now later here.
Oh, where are you?
In southwest France.
Oh, wow.
Finally getting some sunshine, which you guys have been having for the last 2 weeks.
Oh.
It's completely arse about face. Anyway,
all right,
thanks very much.
Here, everybody. Take care.
Cheers.
You
bye.
Too. Take
bye.
Care.
Okay, bye.
Bye.